Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for your patience. You've joined Contracting 101. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. At any time during the call, please feel free to type any questions you have into the Ask a Question box, then click Submit. Should you require any additional assistance during the call, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference may be recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Ms. Alyssa Keehan. Ma'am, you may begin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the United Educators Telephone Roundtable. I'm Alyssa Keehan, Risk Management Counsel here at United Educators, and I'll be the moderator for today's program entitled Contracting 101. I hope everyone received the roundtable reference materials, and if for some reason you didn't get the reference materials, please contact us at risk@ue.org. And at the end of the program, you'll get an evaluation form. It should pop up on your computer screen for those of you participating via the webinar, or if you're participating only through the phone, you'll be emailed an evaluation form. And I just want to encourage you all to fill out the form since we do value your feedback and use that to instruct future programs. We're taping today's program as we do all our programs, so please be sure to check the website, www.ue.org, in the next week for the MP3 file. And our next roundtable will be June 9th on e-discovery. And I just want to quickly remind everyone that our roundtables are not designed to provide legal advice. Okay, I'm very pleased to introduce our speakers for today. Dana Scaduto is the general counsel at Dickinson College. Before coming to Dickinson, she was in private practice where she served as outside counsel for several colleges in central Pennsylvania. Hello, Dana, and thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon. Delighted to be here.
Also joining us is Deborah Brown. Debbie is the Associate Vice President for Legal Affairs and Human Resources at Stetson University College of Law. And prior to working in higher education, Debbie was the Director of Employee Relations for the Walt Disney World Corporation. Hello, Debbie. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Alyssa. It's great to be here.
Now, before we start, I just want to let our listeners know that you will be able to ask questions at the end of today's program, and you can ask your questions actually three different ways. You can type your questions in the Send a Question box to the left of the PowerPoint slide if you're participating via the webinar, or you can email your questions to risk@ue.org, and that email address, again, is risk@ue.org. And in about 50 minutes, we'll give you instructions on how you can call in with questions for our panelists. Okay, I think we've cleared up all the housekeeping issues, so let's get on with our show. At United Educators, our claims attorneys, who handle hundreds of claims from educational institutions across the country, have consistently identified poor contracting practices as one of the most preventable sources of claims that we see involving United Educators member educational institutions. And for this reason, today's program is focused on educating non-legal staff about two aspects of contracting fundamentals. First, why written contracts are important, and second, how to review those written contracts for common terms and conditions. Okay, addressing our first issue, why written contracts are important, I'd like to start off with a scenario taken from an actual claim that we had here at United Educators and get the thoughts of our speakers. Here's the scenario. A student is interning at a theater, and the theater tells the student that it's planning to dispose of lighting equipment that the student's theater professor needs. The student calls the professor and tells him about the opportunity, and the professor tells the student that if he transports the equipment to the institution, the professor will reimburse the student his transportation costs and meal expenses. The student goes ahead and rents a van to haul the equipment to the institution, and while en route, the student runs a red light and hits another car, severely injuring both the driver and the passenger. The driver and the passenger of the automobile sue both the student and the institution. Dana, is there a contract here between the institution and the student, even though there's nothing in writing and neither the student nor the professor signed anything?
Alyssa, it's quite possible that there is a contract, and I think it's essential that our participants today understand that a contract isn't necessarily a piece of paper. It's an exchange of promises where each party promises to give something of value to the other. And the promises don't always have to be in writing to form a binding agreement. Behavior may be enough. actions by the parties, whether by word or deed, can form the basis of a binding agreement. The trick is that if the agreement is not in writing, which is something those of us working within institutions are most familiar with, but if it's not in writing, it's often difficult to determine the party's exact agreement and to determine whether or not their expectations have been met. In the scenario that you just shared with our listeners today, we know the student agreed to transport equipment, and we know the professor agreed to pay for that transportation. That's the exchange of promises. But we don't know when the student promised delivery, if there was a particular time agreed to, which may explain why he got in the accident. Was he racing? Or who bears the risk that the equipment might be damaged or destroyed while in transit, or the risk if the student causes injury to someone else? So this exchange of promises, we often hear it referred to as offer and acceptance in legal vernacular, are what are going to form the basis of the commitment between the parties.
Well, thanks, Dana. And I think it would be helpful maybe if Debbie could use our scenario to give us an example that illustrates this exchange of promises that Dana is talking about.
Sure, Alyssa. When you're thinking about a contract, particularly an oral contract, you're just asking the question, what's the deal? Who has promised what? And in our example, we have promise number one, often referred to by lawyers as the offer. The professor tells the student, if you transport the equipment to the school, then I'm going to reimburse you for your transportation costs. The professor's made the offer. The student says yes and goes out and rents a van and begins transporting the equipment. That's the acceptance. The student accepted and then acted in accordance with that acceptance. To create a binding contract, each party not only has to make a promise, but has to promise to give something of value. Lawyers call that consideration, that something of value. And in our example, we have that thing of value because the professor is promising to pay the transportation expenses. In all fairness, with colleges and universities, you rarely have an issue of lack of consideration, if you will, an exchange of value in the context of a contracting situation. The real problem with this fact pattern that we're working with is it's an oral contract, and many of the terms and conditions are unknown, and you can't really tell based on what actions they took. For example, we know that the student went out and rented a van, but there was no understanding between them. Would the student check the box for additional insurance when they rented the van? Remember, the important thing in determining whether a contract exists isn't whether there's a written document called a contract, but whether there's conduct by each of the parties involved that demonstrates that there was an exchange of promises where each party is giving something of value to the other. And we have that here with the offer by the professor and the acceptance by the student.
Well, thanks, Debbie. That is helpful. And let's briefly look at some examples of the different forms that a contract can take. Dana, can you tell us about the pictures we're looking at right now?
Sure, be happy to. In the slide that's in front of us right now, you have a picture of what Debbie and I would consider to be a typical kind of agreement and the reason that lawyers wear glasses by the age of 40. It's in tiny font, and it is generally part of a long written document. This is the kind of document that most people think of when they hear the word contract. It may contain a great deal of useful information that inform the expectations of the parties, but the challenge is to make sure that when you read it, and I'm assuming that everybody who's negotiating contracts is reading them, that you understand what the expectations and duties are and that they're clearly stated and fairly balanced. Moving on to the next picture, we have the contract on a napkin, and it's kind of the opposite end of the spectrum from the tiny font, long written document. It's far less glamorous, but it actually reinforces Debbie's earlier comment that it's not really as important what the form is, but that it meets those essential elements of offer, acceptance, and consideration. the next thing we have, with the next picture, we have a slide of email, of what might look like your email inbox. And this just gives Debbie, Alyssa, and I an opportunity to point out to the listeners that a contract doesn't have to be called a contract or an agreement to be binding. You have a writing, and as long as that writing contains those elements about which we've been talking, it may in fact be enough to form a contract. Next, we have in front of us what I consider to be one of the most common non-long document kinds of opportunities we have within institutions. You have a purchase order and you have an invoice. And this set of agreements is one I think that most of us have come across or will come across in our careers in dealing with contracts. Both documents are used in the same transaction, and the challenge on these is that oftentimes on the back, they'll contain their own set of terms and conditions. And this is where we get into what lawyers refer to as perhaps a battle of the forms. And our challenge in dealing with contracting issues is to make sure that we don't have standard terms and conditions on these documents that cancel each other out or, worse, are contradictory to one another. And this is an issue that you can often deal with fairly effectively by making sure your agreement has been reviewed within the recent past, within the last 2 to 3 years, by your counsel to make sure that the magic language lawyers use to make sure that the risks of competing terms is minimized, and that's something you can do by contract. And we now have the picture of the ever-so-typical employee handbook. And we use this illustration just to point out the fact that you can have a handbook or other typical document used within your institution that may form a contract as well. Depending on the state and jurisdiction in which our participants are working, a handbook by definition may form a contract. It's also possible in other jurisdictions where a handbook is not necessarily a contract, if we don't use the right language to avoid turning it into one, we could inadvertently do so. So it's important, again, to know what your handbook says and to make sure that if you don't intend for it to be a contract and you intend to reserve for your institution the ability to change terms and conditions of policies, of insurances, etc., that you haven't inadvertently taken that away by language that's in your handbook. And finally, the handshake. The handshake agreement is in fact one that I find more common in higher education than I would have expected. We often find in institutions of higher education that a lot of business gets done this way based on past relationships between the institution and vendors in your community. Doesn't mean it's bad, but it has the same risks that we talked about in the earlier example of being oral and not the precision that we lawyers like to have.
Thanks, Dana. And given all the different forms that a contract can take, why is a written agreement, like the type seen in the first slide you showed us, the most preferable?
It's the most preferable, Alyssa, because you want to use a vetted agreement, a document that everybody can turn to that memorializes the institution's relationship with its partner in business. We want to be able, the written agreement provides clarity that you won't find in a handshake or in form documents, and that clarity helps both parties avoid disputes, make sure that both parties are on the same page with what they expect to achieve, and ultimately then it reduces litigation costs by avoiding the problems caused by ambiguity in the non-written agreement. The handshake agreement, as I mentioned above, as common as I find it, is often one that leads to disputes that destroy those relationships that at its inception we think we're trying to preserve. Had a situation on our campus recently where we were engaged in a building project. We hired an excavator with whom we'd had years-long dealings. When there was a problem with this particular excavation, there was extra rock found at the site. Where the risks were allocated when that unforeseen circumstance arose were absolutely unable to be determined because of the handshake agreement. So the only way to make sure you've got a good written agreement is to make sure that it's in writing, contains the language that is clear and favorable to the institution, is to make sure you've reviewed it.
Well, that's a nice segue to our second topic, and that is how to review written agreements. And I just want to note before we move on that there are a lot of great resources in the resource materials that our listeners received. There's a risk research bulletin entitled Improving Contracting on Campus, Part 1, and it's on page 9 of the resource materials, and it covers a lot of the points that our speakers just discussed. So that's there as well for our listeners. Debbie, because contracts are legal documents that are defining each party's rights and obligations, aren't lawyers really the best suited to review institution contracts?
Alyssa, I have to say yes and no, and far be it for me to try and put lawyers out of business. In a perfect world, it's always yes, that if you could have a lawyer review every single contract that the institution signs, that would be great. But at most institutions, the reality is that non-legal staff review contracts for a variety of reasons. Either they don't have ready access to lawyers, either on staff at the institution or through an outside law firm, or if they only have an outside law firm, then it might be too expensive to have every single contract reviewed. Or for those institutions that do have in-house lawyers, then there may just be a time issue. It's not always the most efficient use of the attorney's time to have them involved in the review of every single institutional agreement. So part of the challenge and the opportunity here is for non-lawyers to build some awareness of the issues that are in contracts so that they at least have a comfort level that they can recognize the type of language that's going to be problematic. And then when they do need to seek legal advice, they're very focused in the questions that they need to ask. And when they don't have access to a lawyer, then they know enough about what contract language means to understand the institutional decision that they're making in deciding to sign a contract that has a clause that might be deemed unfavorable. And every institution is different. Some may set distinctions on the types of contracts that attorneys are going to review and ones that they won't review unless there is something strange or extraordinary going on. And I'll use our campus as an example. Law libraries have huge amounts of resources, including a great deal of electronic licensing of library resource databases. And on an ongoing basis, they are constantly dealing with these electronic licenses. But like here, most institutions would have a library professional who through their own development would be familiar with licensing issues associated with library databases and permissions and will manage and negotiate those agreements. Advertising contracts for media efforts are another great example. Mailing list purchases. When you have conferences or events, it's not uncommon to purchase a mailing list from a professional association. And those contracts are usually fairly simplistic. They have, you know, don't use the list more than once, safeguard the data. Hotel contracts, minor facilities repairs, those are all examples of ones that non-legal staff familiar with the issues can usually manage pretty well. Ideally, institutions that don't have regular access to counsel, they will often develop a checklist of things to watch for, common pitfalls to avoid. For example, in hotel contracts, and I review a fair amount of those, it's always the room block and what's the attrition penalty. And if you have an attrition of rooms you don't meet your room block, what impact is that going to have on your food and beverage costs or on your room rental? Public institutions will often publish standard contract clauses for people to use because of special issues with a state institution contracting, for example. They may have issues of sovereign immunity. Within the materials that Alyssa has referenced you to, if you don't have a current contract checklist, within the UE Toolbox handout, there's a very nice quick reference contract checklist that you can use to become familiar with contract terms and knowing what to look for. Also within the resources, Catholic University has a contract checklist that they use just for independent contractors, often a potential source of wage and hour or tax liability. And the Swarthmore materials has a much broader one and actually includes sample clauses on things that are important for that institution, like if I need a force majeure clause, they have a sample of that. So those are things to resources that can help you with this. Remember, too, that even if you're at an institution that has lawyers, lawyers can really only review contracts for legal issues. They don't really know the facts of exactly what's going on in each department or what the expectations might be, that the broader expectations, what the college or university is hoping to accomplish. So it's always going to be a need for partnership and an ability by the non-lawyer to educate the lawyer on exactly what they're hoping to accomplish. One thing I always tell people who bring me contracts is that it's important for the person who actually has to work with the contract and who is most familiar with the subject matter of what we're trying to do to judge whether the contract language, and I'm not talking about the lawyer stuff that we'll talk about later, the indemnity and all those tricky legal clauses, but the actual substance of the deal, what's being promised, what's being accepted, what are we going to get out of this deal? The person who's actually going to work with the contract is in the best position to judge that. And I'll give you an example. In my position, I review almost all contracts for the law school. It could be anything from a catering contract, a hotel contract, HVAC maintenance is a big issue, advertising. I had a contract recently, an HVAC maintenance agreement, and really it was a small contract in the general scheme of things. We were only talking about spending about $11,000 a year for this preventive maintenance program, but the sensitivity was that the equipment that was being serviced is worth almost $1 million. So if there were a major problem with this vendor, they messed up and damaged our chiller, then it could be serious for us. Now, I saw this contract, and it's like 35 pages long, and it's got schedules of equipment, and it's got the specific tasks to be performed. And there is no way for me to know, is this how many chillers we have? Is this the right list of equipment? Is this the right time frame for the initial inspection? Is this the right schedule of preventative tasks that we want to be done? And it would have been extraordinarily time-consuming for me to go back through the RFP that had been issued that resulted in this contract to try and compare line by line and sort of figure that out. Good chance I could have missed something because I don't work with the HVAC equipment every day. So our facilities department did all of that work, and so they checked the substance of everything, compared it to the bid, and then they came to me on just the issues around liability and insurance and those things that had sort of the broader institutional concerns. Hotel contracts are another very common contract. So if I'm forwarded, for example, a contract for an event, a conference that we were having, I don't know off the top of my head how many people came to this conference last year. I don't know if the dates are right. I don't know if they booked the right number of rooms for the plenary session, for the breakout sessions. I don't know what the speaker AV needs are, microphone, PowerPoint. The conference staff would look at all of that. My role is typically trying to make sure that the conference staff understands the consequences of some of the provisions in the contract that have penalties in some way. Like the conference staff tells me, well, we're projecting in attendance this year is going to be 50 people more than last year. And that's great, and I hope that they meet that. I hope they have 100 more people. But my job is to tell them, well, you understand you have this penalty clause, and so you're booking 200 room nights, and you have an 80% penalty clause. So if you don't book at least 80% of that number, then there's going to be a financial consequence to you. So I want them to have aspirational attendance projections, but I'm also telling them you need to be practical and don't let the reality of your circumstance prevail over the consequences if you don't hit that target. Since I wasn't the one who negotiated the agreement or really any of the agreements that come to me, typically when I'm reviewing the contract, I can't always say that it reflects the party's understanding on the actual subject matter. That's why I always tell people it's critical that I'm the second reviewer, that the person who actually has to implement the agreement, that has to fulfill our side of the promises, whether it's inspecting the work, approving payment, whatever it might be, that the person that's most familiar with it review the agreement. Some institutions as well have other groups involved, risk management, procurement, finance. You could have a number of other people that are typically involved in any institutional contracting process.
Well, Debbie, thank you for sharing your thoughts on who should review campus contracts. Dana, when a campus representative is first presented with a contract, are there any overarching principles that you would recommend they keep in mind when doing their initial read-through of the agreement?
One thing that pops to mind based on what Debbie's just shared with us that I don't think I could impress upon our audience strongly enough is that regardless of who is reviewing the contract or is considering entering it, think institutionally, not personally or by department or division, whatever the contracting unit may be. The overall goal in entering any written agreement is to achieve fairness, and it's not necessarily for the contracting unit, but fairness for the institution which is bound by the agreement, not the department, and to protect the institution's assets. If there is exposure to damages, for example, in any contract, the impact is felt by the entire entity, not just by the unit who's interested in buying a piece of software or bringing in a particular speaker. The coordination between any affected campus departments is critical, and it's important that the person who's considering entering a contract think about, beyond what you're reading on the piece of paper, whether in entering this contract you might be engaging or interfering with the needs of another unit of the institution as well. For example, I recently had a situation where we had an exclusivity provision which in an agreement being entered by one division to purchase a particular point of service system that they were prepared to sign. They sent it to me and just said, let me know if there are any, you know, legal, I love this, just let me know if there are any serious legal problems. I'm not quite sure what that means ever, but going through it, I was aware that there was another point of service system being operated in a different division of the college. I was at first curious why the two hadn't coordinated those efforts on an institutional basis before entering these negotiations, but more immediate to the need, I knew that the entity considering the contract at hand could not agree to that exclusivity provision without immediately being in breach, because we had another contract for that same type of service running elsewhere in the institution. So think institutionally, think across divisional lines, and think about where it is your obligation to protect your institution as a whole and not just your division.
Well, thanks, Dana. Do you have any other kind of overarching themes that you'd have an initial reviewer keep in mind?
Sure. The primary thing for, I think, contract reviewers to consider, it's a very simple checklist. First of all, read it. Do I understand the contract's language? And by that I mean, do I know what my institution is getting? Do I know what we're paying for whatever we're getting? And do I understand when performance will occur? And finally, what happens if something goes wrong? Does the agreement anticipate those worst-case scenarios that we all wish we could avoid? Good contracts should be easy to understand. Stop and ask yourself at the end of each provision you read, did I understand what I just read? Do I understand what I just read? If you're confused or if any words seem nonsensical, then there's a problem, and you should not be offering words that are confusing or nonsensical. For example, if you have the opportunity to use the word before instead of prior, use before. It's more commonly understood. And this is something that I think lawyers struggle to avoid all the time, is you don't need to sound smart. You need to sound clear and simple.
Well, thanks, and I'll pose the same question to Debbie. Do you have any thoughts about some appropriate basic review questions for that initial reviewer to keep in mind?
I do, Alyssa. I mean, Dana is right on with the different questions that you ask, and I really just want to hone in on one of the questions that she mentioned, one of the basic review questions that is always top of mind with me, and that's what happens if something goes wrong with a contract, because that's always the biggest risk. In terms of managing those risks, recognize that you may not know the answer because the contract may well be silent. It may say nothing at all about what happens if something goes wrong. It's just not within the contemplation of the parties that anything could go wrong. some questions to think about, additional questions that can help when you try and read a contract for clarity. And Dana's exactly right. Many people who write contracts, lawyers included, they want to sound smart. They want to write with legalese, and it often makes it very difficult to understand exactly what they're trying to say. But some of the things that you want to watch for that will help is, when you look at your contract, if you realize that there's a problem, can you fix it during the life of the agreement? Is there some clause there that if you and the other side agree, you can make an amendment? If you have it, you always want to make sure that it's going to be in writing to make sure that someone doesn't verbally change your contract. Does the agreement say what happens for things that could occur and make the contract hard to fulfill or impossible, like, for example, dependence on third parties? I had that just this morning. I love HVAC, purchasing a new chiller, and it had language in the contract. Replacing a chiller, as you can imagine, on a college campus is difficult because you have timing issues about how long the chiller won't be working, what period of time won't you have air conditioning, and it's dependent on a third party. If the third party doesn't deliver the chiller on time, then the vendor can't install the chiller. So do you say what happens when you have something like that? Is it an outdoor event? Do you have a weather clause? What if it rains? Do you have a rain plan? What's going to end up happening? Is it a personal services contract where if you've contracted with XYZ singing band and they are the ones that you want, what happens if they get sick and they can't show up? Also, think about what's the risk if non-performance occurs. Is it just embarrassing that, we meant to have this particular thing and it didn't happen? Or will you suffer some real harm as a result? A bad meal is one thing, or a canceled room block. But if your emergency text messaging system fails, that's quite a different situation and something that could be considered mission critical. You know, if you contract for document retention, a document scanning system, and your documents are stored on a third-party server and they're lost, how can you recover from that? So those are things to think about. I also encourage people to think that if you are in a situation where the contract does talk about breaches, they often talk about if things fall apart, then you either pay this or you don't pay that or you're excused from performance. But sometimes if it's something important, you need to look to see if it offers a solution. Like if it's easy to say, you know, an alternate meal selection will be provided or you'll substitute different entertainment on a services contract. But if you have, for example, infringing software, you might end up having to stop using software. So does your contract provide for a workaround solution to keep your systems functional? I can't imagine if we suddenly had something with Banner and we couldn't use Banner because it was found to be infringing. Not that Banner is infringing, but if that were to happen, then does your vendor provide a solution, a temporary solution of non-infringing software while you work through those issues? And finally, you always have to think about the worst case scenario. If there is injury or death, who's responsible, and how are you going to hold each other accountable? What I would say, Alyssa, is one of the things that people should remember is that contract language is negotiable. So in a lot of instances, you can negotiate changes to contract language that you don't like, and I do that all the time. If something doesn't make sense or it's confusing, chances are you can probably negotiate a change because you're probably only looking to clarify what the parties truly mean anyway. It's just written in a way that nobody can understand it.
Well, thanks, Debbie. And in keeping with some of the overarching review principles that both Debbie and Dana just mentioned, such as does the contract language make sense, what am I getting, what am I paying, I'd like to flesh out some of those concepts a bit by doing an exercise and having Debbie and Dana review a mock agreement for issues so that our listeners can follow along. On page 7 in the resource materials, there is a mock contract between a vendor of inflatables called Inflate It All and a fictional educational institution called Halliwell College. Or if you're participating via the web, you can also see the first part of this agreement on the PowerPoint slide. So listeners, you can follow along either by looking at the contract on page 7 in the resource materials or on the PowerPoint slides. In the state contract, Halliwell's chemistry department is renting inflatable labs, not really sure what those are, from Inflate It All for a chemistry open house. Okay, speakers, let's look at the first section of this agreement. It states, this agreement is by and between Inflate et al. Incorporated, also known as IIA, a Rhode Island corporation with a principal place of business at 10 Plastic and Air Plaza, Providence, Rhode Island, and Halliwell's Department of Chemistry, also known as the Department, P.O. Box 341, Halliwell, California, and is effective May 2009. Whereas the chair of Halliwell's chemistry department, Ellen Irwin, Ph.D., needs to acquire an inflatable chemistry lab for Chemistry Open House, an event in honor of National Chemistry Week, and whereas IIA rents and sells inflatable labs. Looks pretty straightforward, seems to be identifying the parties to the agreement and the basic nature of the agreement. Debbie, do you see any potential issues with this section?
Just a couple, Alyssa. First of all, the listing of the parties. As a general rule, institution contract should always be in the correct name of the educational institution and not a department or a division. In this particular contract, in this section, it lists Halliwell's Department of Chemistry. It also references Irwin as the chair of the department. More likely, it's something like Halliwell College, Inc. So just a quick and easy thing to watch for in all contracts. The date's also listed as May 2009, which, of course, is a year ago, so it's probably May 2010 or date of last signature. You always want to watch for the dates. This usually happens when you cut and paste or the vendor cuts and pastes and nobody manages to clean it up. As an aside, if you've been in contract negotiations for a long period and you've gone back and forth with changes and the like, it's always a good idea to have somebody fresh look at it, because once you read something 1,000 times, it all seems to look the same. And so having someone else look at the final agreement for typos or other language issues is often helpful.
Demi, what's the difference between a contract's effective date and its term?
Well, typically the contract term is how long the contract lasts or in effect. The term is from the start to the finish, the effective date to the contract completion. If the contract doesn't specify a start date and an end date, then it often can be construed to create a term of a reasonable duration or an indefinite duration, and that may not be what you really intended. The effective date is when the contract terms and conditions are deemed binding. You have entered a contract and it is in effect, and it's important because that says when the obligation starts. The term is important because that tells you when it starts and when it ends, and each of these triggers typically some action. When the contract goes into effect, people start doing stuff. When the contract is done, typically you're paying, and so everybody wants to know when the contract starts and when it's over.
Thanks, Debbie. Are there any other issues with this opening section here?
Only one thing, and that's the inconsistent use of terms. From the language in this contract, what exactly Halliwell is renting is not exactly as clear as we would like it, just because they're using different terms. In the title of the contract, it says standard large inflatable fun lab contract. In the second paragraph, it's the chair needs to acquire an inflatable chemistry lab. And in the third paragraph, it talks that IIA rents or sells inflatable labs. I, too, have never seen an inflatable lab, and I'm not sure exactly what it is or how an inflatable lab differs from a large inflatable fun lab and an inflatable chemistry lab. But because the terms being used to describe the item being rented are not consistent and we don't know whether they have different types of inflatable labs, it's not exactly clear what Halliwell College is renting or what they can expect to get. Contract writing is not like creative writing. I was an English major. But you want a contract to just clearly describe what you get and what it costs. And so then you want to be sure and use consistent terms for what you're getting and what you're paying for. And once you start varying the words or using synonyms to describe key contract terms, you can create an ambiguity. So it's something always to watch for.
All right, let's move on to the next section, payment. The contract states, IIA agrees to rent 4 large fun labs to the Department of Chemistry for $3,000 each with $12,000 plus tax due and payable within 10 business days of execution of this contract. Any delay in payment shall constitute cause for IIA to charge Halliwell 10% per day on the purchase price. Dana, do you see any potential issues with the language in this section?
The answer is yes, and I think the amazing thing is that just reading at first blush, I think most people, including myself, would tend to think that they understand what they're being asked to pay. And remember, that's one of the key points of clarity that everyone should be looking for in a contract. What am I getting and how much am I paying for it? Here, we have one of those ambiguous terms that Debbie just mentioned is the large fun lab we're getting, the same as the inflatable chemistry lab, et cetera, et cetera. The payment terms are they're either unclear or they're unreasonable, and it's kind of hard to tell which, particularly if this contract dates all the way back to May 9th. When is payment being measured? Those kind of things. How do I make sure that I'm getting what I'm paying for is one question everyone should ask when they're reviewing a payment term. In this case, Halliwell is being asked to pay for these fund labs 10 days after the contract is signed. You think about it from a practical perspective. You're the institution. You're expecting labs to be delivered. And frankly, all I can think of are these blow-up labs that kids jump in every time I come across this term. You, Halliwell, or you, the contracting officer for Halliwell, can't make sure that those labs are going to be delivered on time, in good condition when they are delivered, or function as expected until they're actually on your campus. If you've already paid before they arrive, you lose your leverage to demand performance from the vendor who's delivering them, from IIA. So as far as payment terms go, I think it's always important that you try to link payment as closely as possible to performance. It's possible that IIA will have the same concerns you do, that if they deliver them and haven't been paid, then you've lost your incentive to pay. So you may end up compromising on paying a portion beforehand and a portion after delivery. But think as much as you can and try to get as much as you can to link payment with performance. Also, from a very practical perspective, payment is supposed to be made within 10 days of, let's just say, its delivery or even of execution of the contract. Is 10 days an adequate amount of time within your institution to turn payment pursuant to an invoice around? Typically, in my experience, it is not. Most institutions require 30 to 45 days. As Debbie said earlier, all provisions are negotiable. When you look at this, if you can't meet the 10-day requirement, negotiate for something longer, because point in fact, non-payment, and which includes payment that is not prompt, is almost always considered to be a material breach of the agreement, and you don't want your institution to be put in this position merely because you couldn't turn an invoice around fast enough. And as a mere aside, I'm not sure $10, 10% interest a day is even legal. I think in most states that would hit the usury laws in your state, and that's also something you're going to watch out for. The bottom line is that without clarity on the amount, the timing, and the manner of payment, your institution and you as the contract reviewer cannot evaluate the reasonableness of the fee you're being charged. And you don't want to put yourself in a position where your institution may inadvertently breach the terms of the contract because you didn't understand what you were being asked to pay or when you were being asked to pay it.
All right. Thank you, Dana. And let's look at the next section of the agreement, performance. The contract states, IIA promises to deliver the fund labs to the department, one each in May, June, July, and August 2010. The department agrees to comply with all terms and provisions listed in the customer obligation section of IIA's website, and then it gives a website link. Debbie, what problems do you see with this section?
Just a couple, Alyssa. The first one is the timing appears to be off, and if this contract had ever hit my desk, I assume the department would have caught this. We know it's for National Chemistry Week, so May, June, July, and August doesn't make sense in terms of the delivery schedule. So that's always something to watch for. The thing that is really more troubling is agreeing to terms that aren't in the contract but are incorporated by reference, and this has just become more and more common. IIA wants to bind Halliwell to these terms and conditions on the website even though it's not in the contract. And the problem that you get with this is, what if those terms are unreasonable or unfavorable to Halliwell, or what if Halliwell is subject to them and then IIA changes the terms? Will they even tell us that they changed the terms? At a minimum, you need to read the terms and conditions on the website, review them, and understand them. And just in the context of inflatable fund labs, usually customer obligations include specific things you may be expected to do for safety reasons.
So, Debbie, would you recommend negotiating out contract language which tries to incorporate terms and conditions not contained in the agreement?
If you can, absolutely. But many vendors are going to this, particularly large vendors. So if you can't get out of it, it is sort of the wave of the future. But at a minimum, print it out and read it. And if you can at least get them to agree to date limit the clause so that department agrees to comply with all the terms and conditions listed as of the effective date of the contract, and then print and save a copy of those terms and conditions as they existed on that date, that's at least better, because at least you have clarity of what you've agreed to. Even if it ends up being horrible language and they absolutely won't waive it, at least you know what your commitment is. So should they make changes in the future that are even more horrible, you're at least not subject to those.
All right, moving on to the next section of the contract, modifications. The contract states, this agreement may be supplemented, amended, or modified by IIA. No supplement, amendment, or modification of this agreement shall be binding unless it is in writing and signed by a representative of IIA. Dana, any issues with this language?
Yeah, there are, Alyssa. First of all, let's step back and say, and let me be clear that the idea that a contract may require modification is a common one, and it actually is the benefit of both parties to be able to modify the agreement when things go wrong, particularly if they're modest things, so that the parties can continue to do business together. Contracting generally is not a game of gotcha. Both parties, because we have the exchange of promises and the exchange of something of value, both parties want to see a contract succeed. So there is a vested interest in being able to modify the agreement if, for example, let's just suppose performance has to be, delivery has to be within 30 days, but it's going to be 32 days. Do you really want to declare a breach over those 2 days? And unless it's time critical, you want to be able to modify the agreement to accommodate those kinds of needs. The problem, however, with this modification provision, the one that we're looking at that obviously IIA has drafted and not the institution, is that it's one-sided. Only IIA can modify this agreement. It doesn't even require in the first sentence that IIA put its modifications in writing. And it may leave open the possibility in the second section that Halliwell can modify it, but it's not even clear, and maybe they're just saying our modifications have to be provided to you in writing. That's, frankly, it's not fair. No, neither party should be able to unilaterally act to change the agreement. Most often you're going to want to see a modification provision that allows modifications by either party only made in writing and only if signed by representatives of both parties. Furthermore, you shouldn't be forced into a modification, and you may in fact look for language that says subject to the agreement of the parties or words to those effect. You shouldn't be forced to agree to a modification if in fact it is not in your client's interest, in your interest as the representative of the institution to do so.
Okay, on to the next section, indemnification. The contract states, IIA's liability under this contract shall in no event be greater than the amount paid it hereunder by the department for one large inflatable fund lab. Dana, what are your thoughts about this provision?
Well, first, while we're talking about the topic of indemnification, and IIA has entitled this provision indemnification, what we're looking at is actually a limitation of liability. If you look at the language, again, that might be a lawyer's term for some of our audience that with which they're not real familiar. But when one party, in particular this case IIA, is looking to limit its financial exposure, that's called a limitation of liability. We often have, however, in contracting situations, basically a three-part partnership between three kinds of provisions: indemnification, insurance, and limits of liability. An indemnification provision helps the parties address how responsibility for claims will be allocated among them should an unfortunate situation arise. And you could definitely use one in this situation. In the relationship between IIA and Halliwell, where the parties should be interested in clarifying who will be responsible for damages should a particular situation, whether it's one that results in personal injury, breach of contract, or whatever, who will bear the responsibility for those kinds of losses. Agreeing to accept those kinds of losses is what indemnification is. It allows the parties to consider those issues, shift risk if it's contractually advantageous to do so, or at least clarify at the expectations of who's carrying the risk. You'll also find in many contracts indemnification provisions have many different names. They could be called indemnification provisions. Hold harmless is another term you'll see used. Release, waiver, risk transfer, or exculpatory provision. There's a handful of terms that parties often use to describe the same kind of risk allocation. What's most important is not what the provision is entitled, however, but it's what it actually says. Here, as I mentioned before, we have what I consider to be a limitation of liability clause. And if it's okay, Alyssa, I'll go on and explain just real briefly what that is.
Okay.
Okay. In a limitation of liability provision, in this one, Halliwell is seeking to limit its exposure to the $12,000 IIA is seeking to limit its exposure to the $12,000 it's been paid by Halliwell under the agreement. Your job, members of the audience, when you look at a provision like this, is to decide whether that's enough under your particular circumstances to cover the risk that's inherent in the contract. Debbie gave an example earlier of her HVAC contract at Stetson where she was looking at an $11,000 maintenance agreement on a $1 million piece of equipment. In that case, limiting liability to $11,000 would not have been adequate to cover the damage to the HVAC system if the failure to maintain caused $1 million worth of damage. And that's the same kind of assessment you need to do here. If there's non-performance, if the inflatable labs are not delivered on time and there's no event, maybe $12,000 of exposure would be adequate to cover Halliwell's harm. But what if someone is injured in this inflatable laboratory because it punctures or gases are collected inside and people are hurt? $12,000 is probably not going to be enough to cover Halliwell's exposure in that particular situation or IIA's exposure. And remember, if IIA is not on the hook, Halliwell is probably going to be.
Well, Dana, those are great points, and I just want to note, too, for our audience that since this is a program on contracting basics, we're not going to cover the concepts of indemnity and insurance real in-depth here today, but I should note that for those of you interested in learning more about the nuances of indemnity provisions and insurance, that will be covered in a future roundtable we're going to be doing on contracts, covering more advanced contracting issues. All right, looking at the last provision here, governing law, the contract states, this agreement shall be interpreted under the laws of the state of Rhode Island, and any litigation under this agreement shall be resolved in the district courts of Providence County, Rhode Island. Dana, what are your thoughts on this last section?
Again, this gives us an opportunity to be practical and for the Halliwell representative reviewing this agreement to think that to notice that Rhode Island is on the East Coast and Halliwell is located in California. If there's a dispute over the contract, does Halliwell want to have to go to the courts in Rhode Island or to have to look at the laws of the state of Rhode Island in order to figure out what the responsibilities of the parties are. Having jurisdiction, having governing law, and be in a state with which Halliwell is unfamiliar is going to be inconvenient at best and may in fact be problematic. Generally, when I'm negotiating a contract for my institution, I want to make sure that the law that governs the dispute is the law of the state where we're located. In my case, it happens to be Pennsylvania. And that if we're going to have to go to court or to arbitration to resolve our dispute, that we're not going farther than the borders of Pennsylvania to accomplish those goals. My people are here. I'm here. It's going to be less expensive and more convenient for us to resolve our disputes in the jurisdiction where we're located. If we're not in our jurisdiction, if IIA is successful in dragging Halliwell to Rhode Island, there are going to be increased legal fees. And the big unquantified problem in a lot of contracts is the downtime to the personnel, you who negotiated the contract or you who are trying to perform it. That's also lost revenue. When you're in court or you're in depositions on the East Coast, when you live on the West Coast, it's inconvenient. So it's almost like a sporting event in trying to achieve the home court advantage.
Well, before I go ahead and ask a final question of our speakers, since we're running a little short on time here, I'd like to go ahead and announce that we're opening the phone lines for participant questions or comments, and it's very easy to do. All you need to do is press *1 on your touchtone phone, and you'll be put in line to ask a question or make a comment to one of our speakers. And if you decide for any reason that you don't want to talk, you can press the pound key on your phone, and that will take you out of the queue. If asking a question or comment by phone, just please remember to turn off the listen-only or mute feature on your phone, since we want to make sure that we can hear you when it's your turn. And remember, if you prefer, you can always submit a question anonymously using the Ask a Question box on the left-hand side of your computer screen there, or you can email a question to us at risk@ue.org. All right, so as we wrap up our review of this mock contract, there's still one very important part of this contract that we've not addressed, and that is the signature line. Dana, who should sign this contract on behalf of Halliwell?
I'll try to keep my comments brief, Alyssa, in favor of time. Who should sign depends on who your institution grants signature authority to. And if you don't know that, before you think about putting yourself out there to sign the contract, you need to check. Most institutions grant signing authority only to a few individuals, the president, the CFO or business manager, or in some institutions, department heads. Does your institution have a policy on this? And if it does, you need to know it. If it doesn't, you need to discuss this before you sign. And you need to also be aware that what happens if you sign without authority, the contract itself may end up being void or unenforceable, which is not the situation your institution wants to find itself in. And more importantly, you don't want to end up putting yourself in the position of being personally liable on the contract because you've signed without authority. It could mean, when I say personal liability, it means that the responsibility for financial obligations or performance that you thought were Halliwell's could be yours.
And Debbie, do you have any thoughts here on signature authority before we conclude our program?
Really, just a reminder to our readers that a signature isn't the only way to accept a contract. You can accept it through your actions, too. So if someone sends you a contract and you don't like it, so you decide to just sort of ignore it, but then you actually let the vendor come and start performing, you could actually be deemed to have accepted those unfavorable terms. That's why you always want to get things squared away in a written contract before things start happening under the agreement. You might also have other conditions, like if it's a services contract, getting a W-9 and the like. So it's important to watch for those.
Well, thank you, and we're ready to take our first question or comment now. As I mentioned before, the phone lines are open. Just press *1 on your touchtone phone to be placed in the queue to talk, or, of course, you can ask a question anonymously using the Ask a Question box on the left-hand side of your computer screen or by emailing your question to risk@ue.org. Okay, our first question, the person wants to know, can standard contracts be used for repetitive types of agreements, such as maybe an off-campus college work-study agreement, where only maybe minor components need to be changed? Any thoughts on that? Debbie?
Yes, and actually in a couple of ways. You can have a standard agreement. I'll give you an example. Working at a facility that is older, we have fairly frequent roof repairs. So we will enter into a master institutional agreement for a period of time that spells out all of the details, all the things that we've talked about today, with an understanding that the individual jobs will be done by a work order or a purchase order subject to these master terms. The same with the situation that the question, the person from whom the question came. If you just have a standard recurring thing with only minor modifications, then you can have that standard continuing contract, if you will, and then just have a mechanism for those little tweaks that you need to make from time to time.
And the next question that we received here, it refers to the mock contract. And the person noticed that in the mock contract, it states that the rental price was noted as a purchase price. So I guess it referred to it as a purchase price rather than a rental price, since it was a rental agreement. And they want to know, is that a problem, referring to something as a purchase price when indeed it was a rental agreement?
This is Dana, and certainly it is, and good catch by our listener today, because again, it goes to what we were talking about earlier. You have to understand what you're paying for and what you're getting. If you think you're renting it, and they're and it inadvertently says that you're buying it, I guess Halliwell could decide to try to keep it, and you have a dispute, and that's not what you want once an agreement is signed. You want clarity, and you want a meeting of the minds. You want to make sure that the parties each understand what they're getting, what they're giving, and that expectations are clear.
All right, our next question wants to know, you commented, both of you commented on all the language that was in the mock contract, but was there any language or provisions that you thought were missing from the contract that you would have liked to have seen included? I'll throw this to Debbie first, and Dana, if you want to comment after that.
Sure. This is Debbie. There are always a few standard things. I always like to see what they call a force majeure clause. If things happen externally, like for us in Florida, hurricanes, tornadoes, alligator attack, who knows, some sort of provision that what happens if you have a force majeure in terms of the party's obligations. You usually look for something that's called a merger clause, and it's usually near the end, and it says something like, this agreement is our entire agreement, and all that stuff that we said leading up to this has all been, absorbed into this agreement, which fully states our agreement. So you're not fighting later about, well, wait a minute, in an email 7 months ago, you said you would do X. Well, if that didn't make it into the written agreement, you don't want to be bogged down about it. Depending on the type of contract, the other thing that I'm always very sensitive to is issues of commercial use or exploitation of the college name. As a 501c3, we sort of protect that pretty vigilantly. And so we don't want our name to be used in an endorsement or in advertising or our brand or our logo out there for commercial purposes unless we specifically agreed and consented to that. So I'm always very sensitive about the confidentiality of contracts and any effort to use our name and reputation to further the commercial interests of others. Dana, I don't know if you have any other clauses that you typically want to see or are missing from this.
The only, for purposes of a basic course, the only point, there are two points. One, I want to reiterate from earlier. You want to look at the marriage of indemnification, insurance, and limitation of liability. Those three provisions generally pretty much have a role in every contract. And you need to make sure that the three work in harmony to achieve the goals of the party. You may need help from your college counsel in the first instance so that you clarify your expectations of those provisions, but they do have an important role. And then not necessarily for the Halliwell IIA agreement, but another provision that I am generally rabid about having in an agreement is what lawyer Stanley called representations and warranties. Is there a provision in the agreement that says what an inflatable fun lab or an inflatable lab or an inflatable chemistry lab is and does, so that when it's set up during Science Week, Halliwell gets what it thought it was getting, that they don't show up with the bouncy lab, the bouncy thing, toy that Dana is imagining when she hears this term? Is there something in there that tells you what you're getting in language that both parties can agree to?
Well, thanks, and we've got a couple callers on the line. So, operator, we will take our first phone call.
Yes, ma'am. U.S. Hastings, your line is open.
Thank you. Our question is related to when do you advise that there that a contract be created? In what circumstance do you need a contract?
This is Debbie. I'll try and take the first pass at this. A contract typically should be created whenever you're making an arrangement for goods or services for which you plan to pay a fee. So if you're looking for a commitment from a hotel on a room block, if you're looking to have a meal catered, if you're looking to have a person come and render services, again, some can be very short. I have contracts that I look at that are only a page long with just the very basic provisions because it's a low-risk contract. But I always try and have at least some piece of paper that generally defines here's what you do, here's what we do, and here's how you get paid.
And this,
anything to add?
Yeah, I do, because I think I actually have a little bit different. I agree with what Debbie said, but I also recognize in what she said the inherent risk of saying everything needs to be a contract. I think I agree with her that every agreement for exchange of services needs to be in writing, and to the extent that that's a contract, so be it. But to the extent that lawyers are involved or that you have a review process, I encourage every institution to talk about when is a contract at a level that it requires the engagement of counsel or the review of those terms at a higher level. And what we use at Dickinson, and I know many other schools do as well, is we set thresholds. What is the duration of the contract? If the performance is over longer than a year, that might be a trigger to get it to counsel's office. What's the amount at risk? Is it merely the $11,000 of the HVAC contract, or what's the risk? This is the third point. It's duration, it's cost, and it's risk exposure. Even if it's a modest contract and you might not send stuff off to your counsel to be reviewed until the threshold is $10,000 or $50,000, whatever your institution decides, but if the risk of non-performance is substantial, such as burning up your HVAC system worth $1 million, those are the kinds of contracts when you're setting thresholds that might cause you to kick it to a higher level of review rather than having the simple letter agreement that Debbie described.
All right, operator, we'll take our next phone call.
Yes, ma'am. Our next question comes from Marist College.
That would be me. I have a question about when you mentioned in the beginning about, say, a simple purchase order for services or goods, and you're not going to go into such a great detail as you would with an in-depth contract. If a question came up, what would the silence where you say the contract is silent on that? Because apparently a purchase order is a contract, and a lot of that would be silence. Is there some standard that would apply, or does it depend on the amount of the purchase order or contract?
I'll take a first crack at this one, Debbie. Essentially, when the contract is silent, that's where the concern about the lack of the meeting of the minds of the parties comes in. And then there are several places that the law will look to determine what those terms are. Are there writings outside the contract which might inform what the parties' intentions were? Was there exchange of letter or emails? Is there statutory or common law in your jurisdiction which may say where what the terms would be that are implied in the contract where it's silent on those issues? So it's not as if there's not a way to figure out what the parties intended or what by operation of law the contract may be, but it's harder. And whenever you say harder, that's code for more expensive.
All right. I'll give you our next question. It's an email question. They want to know, what policies can a college impose on its employees when they enter into contracts that they're not authorized to do so? So any thoughts on potential policies that a college can impose on employees who enter into contracts when they're not authorized to do so?
This is Debbie. I'll try and take a first pass at this, and let me just sort of caveat my remarks by saying that if you are in an environment where you have employees subject to collective bargaining as a result of being unionized, you need to have particular sensitivities to that. But aside from that, generally what you'll have is contract policies that designate who has the authority to sign, and they may also designate what happens if you sign a contract without authority. And it can be a range of things, ranging from you'll be subject to disciplinary action up to and including discharge because you're doing something that you've been clearly instructed not to do, to the issue that Dana mentioned, which is personal liability, that the institution reserves the right to repudiate the contract, will not honor its terms, and then you're left out there having acted outside the course and scope of your employment, potentially either coming up with the money for the fund labs, we'll use that as an example, you know, or otherwise trying to fulfill it. I think from a practical standpoint, I doubt many institutions would seek to hold someone individually responsible, but certainly with some of the things that we see in the Chronicle about, you know, expensive personal services contracts with significant buyout clauses, I can see where you can have some dispute over those types of issues. Dana, do you have anything to add on that?
No, I think I think Debbie's given a pretty comprehensive view of it. Thank you.
All right. Well, we'll take one more question here. This is another email question. They want to know, are electronic signatures binding?
In a word, yes. There are very few places left in law where it actually requires a pen on paper signature. There are a host, and I think it's a tribute to the fact that the law is, you know, it's always peddling to keep up with what people are doing. But truth be told, electronic signatures are binding.
All right. Well, thank you, and our time is up today. I just want to thank everyone who participated, and special thanks here to our panelists. We hope that you found our program informative and that you'll check UE's website for further information on our next roundtable, which is on June 9th, on electronic discovery. And please don't forget to fill out that online evaluation form that you'll get at the end of this program, and this concludes today's roundtable. Thank you, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude your program. You may disconnect your lines at this time. Have a great day.